Chapter 25, A Wish Fulfilled. As per our plan, the boy informed his parents, who then informed me, that the boy had decided he might like to spend the entire week at SNL, so he could see how a sketch goes from an idea on paper all the way to a sketch on live television. Yeah, me and him both. I agreed, and 2 hours later, we were both on a prop plane to Gander, Newfoundland. Edward McClintock was a cod fisherman from up Labrador way. Edward's father, and his father's father, and his father's father's father had all been sealers. Edward was not a sealer, but he killed seals. The seal and I make our living the same way, cod. One seal can eat 300 to 400 North Atlantic cod a day, and those are cod I can't catch. Do you follow? Yes, sir, I said. They sound like gluttonous beasts, these seals. I mean, I like a nice piece of cod as much as the next guy, but 300 to 400, well, that's just eating to eat. Speaking of gluttonous beasts, son, your friend has been eating me out of house and home. And he can't hold his drink. I have no use for a man who can't hold his drink. And he motioned toward Adam Egott, who was inert under a quilt beside the fireplace. He handed me his bottle of iceberg rum, and I took a swig of it, and felt nice and warm inside. He can be trusted, sir, I said. He always does what he's told. Fair enough. We'll sit right here and we'll drink till dawn, while I tell you what we have to do to kill a seal. Then in the morning we'll make our way to the floes. But honestly, I think it's a mistake. I can see that by, and he looks frail. This is going to be a rugged sojourn, and the by is pale and his eyes are dim.
The boy is in perfect health, I said.
And so, as Adam Egott and the boy slept and dreamt, Edward McClintock and I talked into the night, as men will do, and we were warmed by the fireplace and the iceberg rum. Finally dawn came and the boy woke up. He was ghastly pale, and Edward McClintock remarked upon it. But when the boy spoke, his enthusiasm for what lay ahead made him appear to be of sound body. He wanted to hear all about the coming adventure, and Edward McClintock said he would tell us soon, but didn't want to repeat anything. Then he got up from his chair, walked to the fireplace, and with his heavy boot, he kicked Adam Egott awake. We sat around the kitchen table as Edward McClintock poured us coffee and warned us about the North Atlantic Ocean. I first traveled this strip of sea as a child on a dare in a small Rodney made for jigging squid, and by luck I survived. But in my youthful pride, I took my survival as a sign of providence, and instead of kneeling in thanks, I stood tall in vainglory. Well, since then, this sea has battered me and froze me. I've lost 4 toes and a finger, and I've been swept under 12 times. The North Atlantic Ocean, she don't care about you and me and whether we live or die. You remember that, boys, and show her the respect she's earned.
"Are you going to make those flapjacks today, Eddie?" Adam Egott asked.
"What?" Edward McClintock snapped.
"Those flapjacks sure are good, Eddie. I could eat those forever."
I saw fire in Edward McClintock's cobalt blue eyes, and I was afraid for Adam Egott, but Edward held himself still until the fire went out. "Yes," he said. "We'll breakfast big this morning. For the next 3 days, we'll be living on herring and rum." We ate a great large meal, and I felt fat and fine. Then Edward McClintock took us to the boat, and we were off to make a young boy's final wish come true. As I looked at the boy, I noticed he was already shivering under his hides, and Edward McClintock had warned us that it would only get colder. I was scared. If the boy didn't live, it was going to look bad for me. Real bad. 6 hours in, the boy developed a fever. Edward McClintock was very concerned and thought we should turn back, but the boy insisted he would be fine. "Yes, he'll be fine," I said, and gave him his pills. There were so many pills. I let him wash them down with the iceberg rum. As we waited to spot a seal, I played a game with the boy. We would look up at the white clouds above and find figures in them. "That one looks like a bird," I said. "Yeah, it does. And look at that one. It looks like a man rubbing his nose," he returned. "I don't see it." "You see the bottom of it? That's the man's chin, and then his mouth is wide open. And then I saw it. And we played this game for 2 days, and we saw alligators and pickles and trees and every sort of thing, all of them white and still and living in the cold and limitless sky. In the middle of the second day, we heard the cries of seals. The boy jumped up, then coughed an awful rattle of a cough, and fell back down. We were all pretty well frozen, and I looked over at Adam Egget, whose tears had become ice halfway down his cheek. Edward McClintock pulled the boat up and threw out a rope, and then took a hammer and smashed a spike into the 3-foot-thick ice and anchored us to the berg. The ice had snow on top, so it wasn't slippery, and up ahead we could see men and hear their gunshots. Damn punks from St. John's with their pistols. That's not how you kill a seal. He took a rucksack from the boat and pulled out a crude ancient weapon. It had a wooden handle and a curved blade at one end. It looked like a cross between a scythe and a bayonet. This is a hackapick, son. The baby harp, she has a skull as thin as a shadow, and it takes just one blow to fell her. But your strike must find the forehead. Then her eyes will open and be glassy. When you touch the eyes, if they don't move, the beast is dead. Do you follow? Yes, sir, the boy said, and smiled broadly. But then he coughed, that awful, empty cough. We had about 100 yards between the seal and us, but they were some of the longest yards I've ever traversed. I had to carry the boy toward the seal. There was a wind, and it howled like a hammer, and I could no longer hear the whimpers of Adam Egget, who slipped and fell every few feet. I hadn't walked for the last 2 days, and my legs weren't working properly. It was as if I had to learn it new, like a foal, and on snow and ice. I knew I couldn't fall for the sake of the boy, so I walked slow, stopped to put the boy down and rest every few minutes, and then I began walking again. We'd only walked about 50 yards when a great weariness settled on me, and I didn't think I could go farther. Suddenly, all I wanted to do was sleep. But Edward McClintock had warned me that the cold will trick a man, and that sleep that sweetly beckons is not really sleep at all, but the deeper thing. So I forced my eyes wide and looked ahead, where I saw Edward McClintock, about 30 yards beyond us, standing still as a rabbit. He turned and fastened his malamute eyes on me, and his voice was clock steady as the frozen words came from his cracked lips. Baby harp. Knowing the creature was only some 50 yards from where I stood gave me the strength to continue. I put the boy down gently like a kitten, and Edward McClintock handed him the hackapick. Are you sure you can swing it, son, or should I help? He asked. But the boy was already on his way, and soon he was standing above the baby seal. We watched, the three of us, while the boy mustered all his strength to swing the hackapick high in the air, then downward and fast, and the seal's thin skull exploded, and a spray of blood fell around and upon the boy. The boy swung again and again until he was awash with the delight of blood, and he was a figure of bright red with the everlasting white behind him. It was as if the creature's very life had somehow leaped into the boy, and the three of us were silent in the witness of this wicked miracle. The boy danced about energetically, singing, while Edward McClintock skinned the seal. Then we returned, and the day was as cold as iron. None of us spoke, but for the boy, who chatted gaily and sang. When I gave him his pills, he laughed and threw them into the North Atlantic Ocean. I made it back to Rockefeller Center at 11:15 p.m. and raced backstage. The rundown was on the wall. Beside answering machine sketch, it read, "Cut after dress." I went to my dressing room, locked the door, and cried. No one but the four of us ever knew of the journey. The boy made a complete recovery and was written up in several medical journals. Everyone agreed that his survival defied worldly explanation. The boy attained a small measure of fame and was even invited to Gracie Mansion, where he met the mayor himself. It was barely reported a year later when, while crossing Fifth Avenue, he was struck by a New York City bus and killed instantly.
I cannot find Norm's essence. It is a problem I've never encountered as a ghost, and I need to truly become him to finish the book. It has always been my great gift, the ability to find a person's essence, but Norm evades me. It must be because I hate him with such intensity. That simply cannot continue. This will be the last book I ever ghostwrite, and I need it to be a fine book. You see, I have a secret, a splendid secret that has kept me going for many years. All the time I have been writing the lives of peripheral celebrities, I have been writing something else as well. It is a novel, the tale of a brilliant painter, a master of surreal involution whose work goes unrecognized by the New York art scene, and so our hero must make his living as a house painter. He becomes known as an excellent house painter, and he makes a fine living from his pedestrian work and nothing from his brash genius. One day, the great artist is commissioned to paint a house. The owner of the house will be gone for a month, and this gives the artist a notion. He decides he will use the house as his canvas. And so begins my novel, The House Painter. And I have finally completed it. In front of me, on my desk, lies the manuscript for The House Painter, beside the half-finished, based on a true story, like gold beside sand.